Then there's the military piece of it, which is also very clearly articulated, that jihad is first and foremost drawing on the experience of the perfect Muslim's life about holy war in the old-fashioned sense of the word. Then there's the legal elements of it, you know, how things are adjudicated. Notably, if you choose to divorce your wife and you say you've divorced her three times, you're done. You're out.
I can hold my axe, but I still wish it was that easy.
Trust me. As Richard Nixon famously said, but it would be wrong. Look, I think that the trouble is that there is simply no counterpart. Certainly in modern Judaism, modern Catholicism, modern Christianity, Zoroastrianism, Hinduism, for one to say that, let's just stick with 86%. That 86% is going to be given a pass because the top 16%, that patina of religiosity, makes it all protected by our Constitution. When in fact the 86% is essentially anti-constitutional and by, you know, statutory definition, what you would call sedition. So to the extent that we focus on this, we try to make it fit our norms. We try, especially our interfaith dialogue folks, try to make it sound as though it's really just like them and you have to treat them just like us. And if you don't treat them just like us, then you won't treat us the way you're supposed to treat us and all that. It just isn't so. As to the idea that you could simply let them come in whatever numbers they want, and migrate, as they typically would do, to places, especially if they're coming from Sharia-adherent countries, where they find sustenance. In Europe, as you probably know, what they've done in overwhelming numbers is they've gone into mosques where they hear Arabic.
Yes.
And this has suddenly dawned on the Germans and the French and the Belgians and others that told the shit, this is a problem. In this country, if they migrate to the mosques, and again, I don't know what the right number is. I've heard numbers as high as 80% have their mortgages owned by NAIT. I don't know if that's right or if it's 30% or if it's some number in between. I do know a man I admire greatly, Zudi Jasser, has had two mosques. In fact, he was one of the people we featured in that film. Had two mosques that were taken over. He founded them, and they were taken over by the jihadists. Zudi Jasser, Z-H-U-D-I, Jasser, J-A-S-S-E-R, Syrian expat. But he's a marvelous man. If you don't know him, I urge you to talk with him. He runs something called the American Islamic Forum for Democracy. He's a naval commander, Navy commander, lieutenant commander. Medical doctor based out in Phoenix, and he is one of those guys who's been standing up, you know, and suffering for it. But my point is this: if I'm right, and I think I am, based on the evidence, that what is happening in these mosques, as you see much more vividly in Europe, is the incubation of jihadism. The demand on the community that they not assimilate. Now, not all Muslims go to mosque any more than Jews or Christians who attend their houses of worship all the time, maybe the high holy days, but not the rest of the time. And thank God, because if more and more of them actually start following the strong horse and going there and get inculcated in this, or find their kids getting inculcated in this, it becomes an even greater problem. So just last point, I think that what Trump has said about migration, and he's evolved it, as you know, but what I think he's essentially stuck with is, if you don't share our values, we really don't want you here. We don't have any obligation to bring you here. And if it's worse than just not sharing our values, but you believe your values must be supreme over ours, you know, it's suicide to bring more of them in. Now, the numbers, which you raised the question about, it depends on what the problem is. Are you anticipating that you will suddenly be a Muslim-majority country? Well, obviously, we're a long way from that.
Yeah.
At the other end of the extreme, are you looking at what 19 people did to lots of our countrymen and our economy? Well, probably you're looking at something in between. And what makes me so concerned about this civilization jihad business is the effort that's clearly being made to try to get to a tipping point, as I said. And you know, if you look on the internet, you'll find all kinds of theories on this, that, you know, at 1% of the population, the behavior is such and such. At 5% of the population, at 10%, it's...
10% becomes a very significant minority.
Pardon?
10% becomes a very significant minority.
Well, especially if it's,
yes,
you know, very directed in a sort of supremacist way. And look at France. I mean, they are facing it at the moment. So I guess my view of this is that... whatever the number of jihadists we have in this country is at the moment, and I have no idea what it is, it's too large. And adding to their numbers willy-nilly, or in the notion that, well, we just can't discriminate against anybody, is truly a formula for national suicide.
How much of a hearing do you expect you guys are going to have at the, or how much, I don't want to say access, but in terms of your influence on the Trump administration, not just Donald Trump himself, but others around him? Do you expect that you've had some influence and that you'll continue to have some, or you're just one of many?
I don't know. Honestly, I don't know. I think I walked you through this speech on the 15th of August.
Yeah.
Remind me again,
it's been such a busy last.
Well, the 15th of August was a speech that he made, and I don't remember where he made it, Trump. But he laid out what I think of as the plan for victory over jihad. He didn't use that word, the term. He talks about radical Islamic terrorism. But the elements of it, which pretty much are in alignment with what we've been arguing, whether that's cause and effect, I can't say. But he talked about the need to stop importing jihadists. Again, my words, not his, but that was the thrust of it. To undo the Iran deal, to end the practice of willful blindness, to defeat the Islamic State, by which I think he means not simply that as an entity, but the violent jihadists. And as important as anything, he talked about countering the networks that are radicalizing Muslims in this country. A number of the people that he has tapped are people I admire and to varying degrees have worked with over the years.
Who would you say?
It's a matter of public record. I don't want to go encourage you to make this the story about all of the people.
There's going to be an element of something there. So.
I'm quite sure of it. But I just want to say, I think that... the kinds of appointments he's made so far are people who understand something that your newspaper in particular and most of the press, both the traditional and the new, have not. And that is that there's a serious school of national security thought and practice that is behind, or at least built upon, the kind of work that I've shared with you today. And I think they're going to be represented in this administration. And I hope, as a result, we're going to get what Donald Trump promised on the 15th of August and before and since, which is a course correction. Because I think there's really very no disputing the fact that the public is very concerned about the course that we've been on. 15 years of a largely unsatisfactory and certainly costly and not terribly effective war.
That's fair enough. I would agree with you on that. Yeah. I think our newspaper and you would agree on that point. The wars haven't been that effective.
We would disagree about why.
Yes.
And the point is, I think the reasons that your paper might conclude is where we've gone wrong would only make things worse. I mean, they would be taking us even farther down the trajectory we're already on. Lastly, I'll give you this, because I think it's kind of, in some ways, the most important of the things that we've produced. We took a cut with what we call a tiger team of people at trying to figure out what a strategy for victory over jihad would actually entail. And partly, frankly, thanks to, you know, the experience that I had had and a number of others with Reagan's strategy for defeating the last totalitarian ideology that explicitly wanted to destroy this country, namely Soviet communism, we used it as a template for what you might do against this one. Because while there are obvious differences, I think overwhelmingly there are things that are very similar between communism of the Soviet style and what I kind of think of as communism with a god, the Islam style. And, you know, there were some obvious places where things that Reagan didn't have to contend with, like cyberspace, that needed to be updated. But more or less, it mapped pretty well when you argue that if this is truly an existential threat to freedom, and I think it is, you need to utilize all instruments of national power to defeat it. And so that's basically the alternative we haven't tried yet. Yeah. I don't think your paper, and I don't think any other paper in this town for sure, would get their head quite around that. It remains to be seen whether the administration will or not, but I certainly get the sense from what I've seen so far that the sorts of people that have been tapped are people who intuitively get, partly because, as I said at the beginning, they're national security minded, and a fair amount of them very experienced. A fair number of them have had the kind of direct mano-a-mano contact with this threat that you've had. And I think they may, in some instances at least, have participated in Reagan's, you know, strategy.
Yeah.
But at the very least, they understand that the kind of course that we're on now is simply unsustainable in the formula for defeat.
I think that about wraps it up. I'm sure I've got other questions I'm forgetting now because
it's been, I've worn you out.
Well, no, it's been just one of those weeks I had this stuff to do and then all this travel, and then my iPhone cracked, and I've been trying to get harder to get an iPhone cracked around Christmas time than you'd imagine. It's Carly at the Apple Store hopefully getting fixed now. That's my old one. So I'm just
good to have a backup.
Yeah, you kind of need them. But this has been really fascinating for me, partly because I've been away from sex for a long time, and I always wondered what the kind of, to the outside, it looks like an obsession with the Muslim Brotherhood is. You see it coming from kind of say, they'll call it the right, I don't call it. And when you're not really thinking about it or looking at it, doing other things. So I was kind of curious about what the intellectual underpinnings of war, and this has actually been enlightening. I think you probably also find there's some more people than you'd imagine at the Times probably agree with you on the, at least the university stuff, and some of the relativism of the left kind of, it's what makes it different from other immigrant experiences is that when my grandparents came here, great-grandparents and grandparents, nobody's growing up going to college and being told, no, you should embrace this. The message you got the entire time was assimilate, don't worry so much about that. And that it's a weird alliance where suddenly, like, you know, the left supports groups that are incredibly intolerant, and people come to colleges and are told to embrace things where, even when I was in school in the 90s, there was some of that. And, you know, as Jews, it's those crazy religious Jews. They're critical mass of Jews who are assimilated is too big already to kind of turn much of us into crazy religious ones, but you'd occasionally get it from, you know, Jewish Students Association. It's only, we should all be more religious. You're like, why am I even here? I didn't go very often. And so, yeah, I think there's, you know, That's an interesting dynamic that I actually haven't thought much about before. Yeah. And the kind of taking parents and making their children into much more religious people. And how that's kind of not just frowned upon, it's encouraged.
Or taking children and making their parents
into That's what I meant. Sorry, taking children. Yeah. Going
back to the door. No, I found that that was such an interest. I mean, I hated the film.
Yeah.
I hated what had happened to ours and what resulted. But that, I've told that story a number of times because I think that's such a perfect paradigm of what I'm describing here. And just a last thought, if I may. I think what has to happen.
While you're talking, I'm going to email somebody who's supposed to call it. Or they're going to tell them, I'm going to push it.
No, I'll be done in 2 minutes.
Phone call. I want to push it back anyway, so I'm going to stop and get some lunch. Sorry, continue though, while I've got a recording.
I'm of the view that the ultimate outcome here will be determined by persuading that hippopotamus, if you will, that the guys trying to draw them into non-assimilation, into Sharia adherence, into anti-constitutional beliefs and values and practices are not the winning side. And that's partly a kinetic thing. And, I'm hopeful that the guys who do that will do it more effectively in the future than they've done to date under the rules of engagement and, nostrums and coin strategy and hearts and minds and all the rest of it.
You may well get the kind of father of all that in the government as well at this point.
You might as well get what?
The father of all that in the government, or the guy who claims to be the father of all of it.
Petraeus. Oh, Petraeus. I don't think so. I don't think so. Partly for that reason, actually. But anyway, it's not an obsession with the Brotherhood, truthfully.
But I said it looks like an obsession to the outside. That's why. The way you explain it isn't an obsession, but to the outside it does look like it.
I think the reason that we devote as much time and energy to it is that it has to date not been a focus like the kinetic side has.
Yeah.
Not remotely the resources, not the intellectual effort. I mean, Seb Gorka often talks about the contrast between the level of effort that was made during the Cold War, particularly early in the Cold War, to understand Soviet ideology and doctrine, orders of battle, and all of that. There's nothing remotely like that these days. And to the extent that academic institutions are dabbling in this field at all, they're more often than not like my alma mater, Georgetown, which is, in literally the pocket of Al-Walid bin Talal, for God's sake.
Yeah.
Not helpful to the understanding of the enemy, needless to say. But properly understood in terms of the actual threat to a free society like ours, it is the subversive, inside-the-wire takedown that I believe is vastly more dangerous, which really goes back to your last question, Matt. You said, how can this be that big a problem because there's so few numbers? If they actually are successful, either on their own or more likely in concert with leftists who have a similar kind of intermediate goal, at least, to rot out and undermine confidence in our institutions and constitutional freedoms. I mean, I could go on all day, so I know I'm keeping you from lunch, but just a final point. To yours, at the end of the day, what is going on campus right now? Yeah. It is the leading edge of the OIC effort. It just happens. The plan of action of the OIC, adopted in December of 2005, a 10-year plan of action, supposedly ended in December of last year, is about suppressing freedom of speech, which is an incredibly important technique if what you're trying to do is stealthily subvert a country from within. To the extent you can suppress those who are saying, wait a minute, they're here, they're doing bad things, it's very dangerous, it infinitely improves your chances of success, right? So that's what this is largely about. And I believe that, you know, the rather concerted efforts made to vilify me and marginalize this organization and others we work with has to be understood as an information operation, part and parcel of an influence war and the jihad of the civilization variety. And properly understood, you can actually do something about it. And I'm thinking that that's what this administration is going to do. I pray.
Look, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me.
I can't tell you how much I appreciate you taking the time.
I mean, you know, like you said, when I asked my question, it's like, be the first to say there are a lot of bad journalists out there.
And editors.
Yes. You can't really write about what somebody thinks if you've never asked them what they think.
Oh, you can.
I mean, you can.
You can do it all day long. You can do it all day long if you're willing to simply say the SPLC says this is what they think, and therefore you don't even need to ask them what they think, because as long as you've got the SPLC certification, that passes for authoritative rendering. I mean, this is outrageous, and it's I think a prime example of shoddy journalism.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's, you know, kind of, and I think it's I see it more from the left, the center left side of things, where I tend to be honest, where I live and work. And I see it, though, on the right as well, where, you know, the big problem of people stop asking each other what they think, you know, and relying on things like, well, they say this, or this group says they think this, which is a, you know, it devalues all the dialogue. It's how you end up with stuff like this. It's how you end up with people not kind of coming to share our values.
Yeah.
It's what happened in Europe.
Yeah.
Europe's like, you know, I have a good friend who's German intel guy, who maybe they've got a chance. The Dutch are just a disaster. I mean, it's been so long, and you just look at them like, guys, nobody's going to stand up for your own kind of what you want in your country if you don't do it yourselves. You know, I mean.
But it's just one example of the larger problem. And you know, what's interesting about this, and if you take a look at that, I think you'll find that particularly valuable. What is happening there, and what now Google and Facebook and Twitter are all imposing here, is the imposition of the OIC Sharia blasphemy standards, now enshrined in what's called UN Human Rights Council Resolution 1618. Yes. Friends of mine, including Geert Wilders, are being prosecuted in the Netherlands by their government on the basis of that OIC standard. And not just there, but elsewhere. And so to the extent, again, those are now, I've had this conversation, I don't know if you have, but people who I work with are now very reluctant to say things on the phone or in emails in Europe, lest they too have these folks coming down on them. And that is a formula for, you know, submission, as
in,
I said.
The same way our freedom of speech and religion laws can be problematic at times, they're also our saving grace. Like, you know, and I include this on stuff about Holocaust stuff. The Europe's laws are ridiculous. I mean, I get why they thought maybe they were a good idea. I guess at the time maybe it seemed like it. But they're a terrible idea.
They are.
You know, if you can't convince people, sure, not going to be able to legislate the solution very well either. There'll be other ways around it.
But just
and the blasphemy, and that's a that's a classic case of it, is where you let one part of a society define how everybody else should talk about it, rather than saying, you know what, everybody's going to talk about it any way they want, and what they say we don't care. We care what they do. So if they come and they burn down your house, then they're going to go to jail for arson. You know, leave it at that.
Right. In this case,
yeah.
And you saw it with Loretta Lynch after the Orlando attack, going to one of the Muslim Brotherhoods, not on that list because they were relatively recent Muslim advocates,
yeah.
Within a day, I think, of the attack, and saying in a speech that was pre-organized, but it just happened, she was doing the keynote address for the Muslim advocates, the Muslim Brotherhood front group, very much involved with the Justice Department's outreach and policy setting and so on. And she said, and again, this is a paraphrase, I think, but it was essentially this, you know, I am most worried that people will be saying things that will result in attacks on Muslims. And we will basically be prosecuting people if they start moving in that direction. I mean, it was clearly an erosion of that First Amendment, right? And it's, you know, what is hate speech? Hate speech is something that tells you whether a specific action is motivated by hate or just a criminal activity. Well, once you start establishing that that's how you know, then you start prohibiting not just the action, but you start prohibiting the speech. Once you start prohibiting the speech, you've got people arbitrating whether it is or it isn't. And I'll just tell you, you know, you look now at this whole fake news agenda, bullying, safe spaces, trigger warnings. I mean, you go right down the litany, and it's amazing how well it at least will be, you know, exploited. I'm not saying it's all, you know, organized but it will be exploited by enemies of freedom, for sure.
It's quickly depressing how quickly the fake news went from taking on things that were demonstrably bullshit to becoming anything you don't like is an label fake news, where that's obviously not true. And but you will find a fellow traveler in the view of hate crimes, which I'm just like, to the person that's a victim of the crime, whether it was motivated by prejudice or just plain old you wanted their money, you still got beat up or murdered. It sets apart a standard.
Pretty hateful thing.
Yeah, there's like your dignity's been violated in the same way. So why does it matter? Like we don't, and that intent should matter in as much as it proves, you know, the severity of the crime. So you know. You need intent for murder, one, but what the actual intent was, it shouldn't. That's like what's in my again, you know, what's in my head and heart is my business. What I do in my everyday life, how I treat other people, you know, that's different. But when it comes to like the hate crime laws, I'm just like, you know, vandalism is vandalism. Like we have laws for assault, we certainly have laws, and for murder, you know, we absolutely have laws. Why? The fact that it's a hate crime shouldn't matter more. I feel the same way, though, when it's like, you know, comes to police officers. Like, if you attack a cop, it should be the same assault for everyone. I'm kind of creating different classes of people and laws a little stupid and detrimental in the end.
Insidious.
Yeah, insidious. Exactly. That's the word I'm looking for. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm going to give you your pen back.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I appreciate you.
I'm going to steal this bag, though, to carry it.
Please do. Yeah. And there's more where that came from, needless to say. But,
and, you know, I'll tell you a quick anecdote myself, which is the David Petraeus anecdote. Mm-hmm. Both of you are not huge fans of him either. For different reasons. But when I was in Afghanistan, I went to interview him. I said, stole the journal. And it was right before, what's the church that they keep burning Qurans, what they called? I forget the name of it. They were about to do one of the Quran burnings or whatever. Petraeus decides, we weren't going to ask about it. We don't really care. Decides to give me and a colleague sitting at ISAF headquarters in Kabul a quick statement, kind of imploring this guy not to do it, you know, and saying it's going to be dangerous for our troops. And I thought to myself, what the fuck, dude? Are you kidding me? Like, the guy's not burning a Quran in Afghanistan, which is against the law. It's their country. It's the laws they want. Not my problem. Like, you know, but if this whole thing here is for an idea. If we're fighting this idea, we can't stand up and say, look, I think it's a terrible, porn thing to do, but our Constitution protects it. We're not going to stop it. And I hope you understand that. And, you know, we would never do that here. We want to respect your laws, too. Why was that such a hard statement to make? If you can, and that's one thing we really do fall down on a lot of those countries, is we spend too much time apologizing for normal things.
No, but freeze that frame.
Yeah.
Matt, because that's exactly what I'm talking about in microcosm is happening writ large, where we've gotten to this point where we've been told by these guys, and this is where that brotherhood piece comes in. They're very shrewd about saying, oh, we wouldn't come slit your throat if you published Charlie Hebdo's stuff, but they'll come slit your throat. So we'll tell you, don't think about doing it, and then they won't slit your throat. You know, it's not actually that they're interested in our freedoms and our, and that's why I say CARE is not a civil rights organization promoting and protecting our freedoms. Yeah. It's actually, you know, enabling that submission agenda. And that way really lies perdition, I think.
Look, I really appreciate taking the time.
I'll walk you out.
Cool.
So, I appreciate you.
So, how many times do you get screwed by journalists and decide to record everything?
Daily. Pretty much.
Thank you. lights on. I had to figure out the video stuff.
I see.
If I could, I'd just keep it dark in there.